Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, January 23rd, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the judicial challenge to the NLRB recess appointments. My name is Christian Corrigan, Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Our experts join us today because on January 4, 2012, President Barack Obama announced recess appointments of three members of the National Labor Relations Board. These appointments are controversial because the United States Senate was, by its own rules, not in recess at the time, conducting pro forma sessions every 3 days. Several appeals from board decisions by panels that included recess appointees have been filed by various parties challenging the recess appointments as unconstitutional. An appeal filed in the Seventh Circuit by non-union workers, represented by our first speaker, National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation staff attorney, Mr. Glenn Taubman, was the first of those cases to be argued in a U.S. Court of Appeals on November 30, 2012. An appeal filed in the D.C. Circuit by an employer was argued by our second speaker, Jones Day partner Mr. Noel Francisco, on December 5, 2012. A more complete bio for our speakers was provided to you in notice of the call, so I will stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. Mr. Taubman, the floor is yours.
Thanks a lot, Chris, and thanks to the Federalist Society and to Noel Francisco for joining me today and to all the listeners out there that are interested in this timely topic. So thanks to all of you. In a way, this recess appointment issue goes back to the founding of the Republic, but in a way, it goes back to 2010 when the Supreme Court issued its decision in New Process Steele. In New Process Steele, the court held that the NLRB must have at least three validly appointed members for it to function and issue decisions. Normally, the NLRB has up to five members, and the court held that there must be three for the board to have a valid quorum. Here, NLRB member Craig Becker's own recess appointment expired no later than January 3, 2012, and the board dropped down to two members at that time. No new members have been confirmed by the Senate since then. So only if President Obama's recess appointments of January 4, 2012 were valid has there been a proper quorum of board members to issue decisions. And this is the status for now a little bit over a year. The Richards case, the one that I was involved in that went to the Seventh Circuit, began as a challenge to certain nationwide policies of the Steelworkers Union and the IBEW, the Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Union, related to non-members' rights under Communications Workers versus Beck. Various non-members challenged some of those unions' Beck policies. In August 2011, a validly appointed board issued a ruling in favor of Mr. Richards and the other employee charging parties on the merits of their challenge. But that board declined to issue any retrospective remedy for hundreds of similarly situated non-members across the country. Mr. Richards filed a motion for reconsideration seeking relief for the entire class of similarly situated employees, and that was pending before the board when the recess appointments occurred. When the recess appointments occurred, Mr. Richards and others also filed a motion for disqualification of those appointees based on the illegality of the appointments. Finally, on April 12, 2012, the board, now filled with the challenged recess appointees, denied the motion for reconsideration and denied the motion for disqualification. That's when the case went to the Seventh Circuit because we now had a final order, except we had a final order that was decided by the board, which included the recess appointees. Before the Seventh Circuit, we broadly attacked the recess appointments, and the main arguments were as follows. First, We argued that the Senate was in session when the appointments were made, and that under the Rules of Proceedings Clause of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 5, the Senate alone gets to make its own rules and set its own schedule. And here, on December 17, 2011, the Senate voted to hold pro forma sessions every 3 days until January 23, 2012, and those sessions were in fact held, and legislation was passed at one of those sessions. And I would add that this legislation was sought by President Obama. So we argued again first that there was no recess, that the Senate, under its rules, gets to make the call as to whether there's a recess or not, not the president. We also argued that the Constitution sets up a system of joint appointment powers, of advice and consent over presidential appointments, and that it does not give the president a right to make any recess appointments. Any power that the president may have to make such appointments is wholly derivative of the Senate's power to declare a recess under the Rules of Proceedings Clause. And only when a legitimate recess is declared by the Senate does the president have any such power. And finally, our briefs directly raise what I would call the originalist arguments about the Recess Appointments Clause. The first of these arguments is that the recess appointments were invalid because the vacancies that were filled did not happen during the recess of the Senate. If you look at the plain text of the Recess Appointments Clause, it says the president shall have the power to fill up all vacancies. That may happen during the recess of the Senate. And we argued that these recesses had been pre-existing for months or even years, and so because they did not happen during the recess of the Senate, they could not be filled via a recess appointment power. And we cited statements of founders and early scholars who believed that the Recess Appointments Clause only applied where the vacancy occurred or happened during the recess. And second, the other originalist argument is that the recess appointments were invalid because the Constitution only allows for recess appointments during an intersession recess, that is, between the annual sessions of the Congress, not during one of the sessions. And that's based upon the plain language of the clause that says vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate, not during any recess of the Senate. Oral argument was held in the Seventh Circuit on November 30th in Chicago. With regard to the recess appointment issue, several things stand out from the questions that the panel asked. First, the panel seemed to believe that the president is entitled to a presumption that anything he does is constitutional, which obviously makes any challenge tougher. The panel also seemed to believe that the Senate, not the president, was playing games in this case in the way it set up the pro forma sessions. One of the judges said that she felt as though the Senate was trying to have its cake and eat it too by creating these pro forma sessions that would deny the president power to put in recess appointments, but that the senators weren't actually physically present. However, as I pointed out, the senators actually passed legislation during one of the pro forma sessions, and so whether members are physically present or not is not particularly the issue. Unfortunately, the Seventh Circuit ducked all of these recess appointment issues in the Richards case. On December 26, 2012, the court held that Mr. Richards and the other charging parties lacked standing to challenge the recess appointments because they had gotten all of the relief that they had sought for themselves and that they could not pursue additional relief for third parties. So the Seventh Circuit was able to duck this critical issue, which is unfortunate for all of us. But I will add, before I turn it over to my colleague Noel, is that There are quite a few other cases pending in the D.C. Circuit and other circuits. And Knowles' case is, of course, the most important one that is pending now. But I just want our audience to know that the Fourth Circuit has scheduled oral argument in the first of its recess appointment cases. That's Enterprise Leasing versus NLRB, which is scheduled for oral argument in Richmond on March 22nd. So the challenges continue in various circuits. And with that, I would turn it over to Noel Francisco.
Thanks, Glenn, for that excellent summary, and in particular, doing the work of sort of walking through the nuts and bolts of the arguments, and you can that relieves me of having to do that as well. Also, thanks to the Federal Society for putting this on, and to all of you for taking your lunch hour to listen to us talk about this somewhat arcane but exceedingly important topic. One of the things that I find interesting about doing this type of litigation is, in addition to the underlying legal constitutional questions about the extent of government power and executive power, are the types of strategic issues that arise in litigating this type of case. I represent two basically public interest groups in this litigation, the United States Chamber of Commerce and the Coalition for a Democratic Workplace, both of whom have strong interests in ensuring that the president's appointees to agencies like the National Labor Relations Board reflect constitutional principles. So when the president made these unlawful appointments about a year ago, we instantly started following the NLRB's docket to identify a case that we thought would present a good vehicle for attacking the president's challenges, because one of the problems that we often run into in this litigation is, as Glenn unfortunately found out the hard way and as we all struggle with in these cases, is finding a client that has a clearly justiciable claim. I think Glenn's client did. Unfortunately, the Seventh Circuit disagreed, but you often face that hurdle. So what we try to do from the outset is identify a client where there cannot possibly be such an argument raised. And the Noel Canning case, and it's unrelated to me, the Noel Canning case was the first such case that we encountered. Noel Canning is a small Pepsi bottling facility based in Yakima, Washington. It got into a dispute with its local union that resulted in the National Labor Relations Board issuing an unfair labor practices finding against it. That finding, however, was issued by a board that contained three members who, in our view, were unlawfully appointed, and hence a board that lacked a quorum and the authority to issue the order in the first place. So once we identified this case, we instantly reached out to Noel Canning's counsel and formed an alliance where we would join forces to both protect Noel Canning's narrower interest in its specific dispute with its labor union, and the Chamber of Commerce and the Coalition for a Democratic Workplace's broader interest in ensuring that the run of its members, which include a vast array of companies, have their rights protected in the proceedings that they find themselves in before the NLRB on a daily basis. So that's basically how we identified the case. And at that point, it was just a matter of teeing it up and bringing it to the D.C. Circuit. One other interesting thing that I think helped lay the groundwork for our case and help make it one of the major focuses of this dispute was it's the one case where the Senate minority, the Republicans in the Senate, formally filed an amicus brief in our support, and at the argument, the Senate's counsel, Miguel Estrada, actually presented argument alongside of me. So we felt that that was important so that there was at least some institutional interest by the Senate being represented before the court, even if it was the interest of the minority Republicans as opposed to the majority of the Senate as a whole. I think what turned out to be the most interesting part of this case was how things ultimately unfolded at oral argument. And in order to understand this, harken back to the arguments that Glenn did a great job of outlining as to why these recess appointments were or were not constitutional. Our principal argument was one that was based on essentially unbroken executive branch precedent dating back to, I believe, 1921. From the founding of the country through about 1901, it was largely accepted that recess appointments could only be made during what is called an intersession recess. That is, when an official session of Congress ends, generally, you know, in December or January, and the next Congress begins. That break in between two sessions, when the senators at the founding would, you know, get on horseback, ride back out to their homes, spend several months at home, and then return back to Congress. Those were the periods when the president was authorized to make a recess appointment. No president save Andrew Johnson attempted to make an intercession recess appointment until the 1920s. And as you may recall, Andrew Johnson was impeached for appointment-related offenses, so the fact that he was the sole exception to the otherwise unbroken rule is not particularly persuasive precedent on the government's side here. Fast forward to 1901, we find the first executive branch opinion ever to squarely address the issue, and there the executive branch expressly disclaimed the power to make recess appointments other than during an intersession recess appointment. That's particularly important because here you have the executive branch issuing an opinion that limits the president's power rather than expands it. Usually you expect it to go in the other direction. So when an actor actually issues an opinion limiting his or her own power, that's particularly persuasive authority in favor of that interpretation. It wasn't until 1921 that the executive branch for the very first time took the position that the president was allowed to make intra-session recess appointments. That is, recess appointments that occur during these small temporary breaks that occur during a session. So from 1921, the president claimed that power. From 1921 until around 1976, it was used sporadically by presidents. I think there were three presidents during that time period who made no intra-session recess appointments at all, but rather limited their recess appointments to the traditional inter-recession recess appointment power. But then it was during the Carter administration that presidents for the first time started to really aggressively use this intra-session recess appointment power in order to circumvent Senate advice and consent. In other words, they used it when the Senate wouldn't confirm the president's nominees. The president would wait till the Senate took one of these short breaks, would make a recess appointment during that time, and hence end run the president's advice and consent power. Once Carter started doing it, it then picked up considerably amongst presidents of both political parties, with President Reagan continuing President Carter's tradition of using this as a tool in his fight with the Senate over the confirmation of these nominees. So with that backdrop in mind, our principal argument was that based on this consistent line of executive branch precedent starting in 1921, no president had ever attempted to make an intra-session recess appointment unless the Senate had in fact adjourned for more than 3 days. And that three-day rule comes from a separate constitutional provision called the Adjournment Clause, which requires both houses of Congress to consent before either absence itself for greater than 3 days. Ever since 1921, when the president first asserted the power to make intra-session recess appointments, the Department of Justice has made clear that there needed to be some kind of limiting principle on that power. Because if there weren't, the president really could make a recess appointment overnight when the Senate broke for lunch, when the Senate broke for a weekend, and that would be absurd. So the executive branch has consistently said that the constitutional floor, the absolute minimum, where you could even possibly conceive of making an intra-session recess appointment, was where the Senate adjourned for a period greater than 3 days in accordance with the adjournment clause. Here, you'll recall that the Senate session began on January 3rd. The president made the so-called recess appointments on January 4th, and the Senate held another session, I think, on January 6th. So you did not have a three-day adjournment by the Senate. Hence, there was no recess here, even assuming the president got to make an intra-session recess appointment at all. So that was our principal argument, and we supported it primarily using executive branch opinions themselves, including the Office of Legal Counsel opinion that accompanied these recess appointments, which acknowledged this long-standing three-day rule. That was our principal argument. Our secondary argument was the one that Glenn described that was based on the original understanding of the Constitution. That is that even if you don't agree with our primary argument, you should go back to the original understanding and hold that intra-session recess appointments are absolutely prohibited. You can never make them. You're only allowed to make recess appointments during inter-session recesses. The reason we made that our secondary argument was because we suspected that courts would be reluctant to reach that broad argument when there was a narrower basis upon which it could decide the case, a narrower basis that reflected unbroken precedent, at least executive branch precedent, since 1921. The third argument is the position that the Department of Justice advanced in this litigation. And what was interesting about the Department of Justice's position in litigation is that it was very different from the Department of Justice's position for the last almost 100 years. The Department of Justice effectively abandoned the three-day rule that it had always adhered to. I think because it recognized that if it applied Department of Justice precedent, it would lose the case. Instead, the Department of Justice's position was that the president could make a recess appointment whenever the Senate took a recess under the plain meaning of the term recess. And to develop the plain meaning of the term recess, it looked to dictionaries from the 17 and 1800s with contemporaneous definitions of the word recess, pursuant to which a recess was essentially any break from one's ordinary business. Now, I can sort of see why that argument would have appeal to certain judges. The problem with the government's argument, though, was that it really did mean that the president could make a recess appointment when the Senate broke during the lunch hour, because the plain meaning of the term recess plainly includes when one takes a recess in order to go out and have lunch. And if you look at the Senate's records, they frequently refer to their lunch breaks and overnight breaks and weekend breaks as recesses. In order to get around that absurdity, the government carved into its plain meaning test what it referred to as a de minimis exception. And the de minimis exception excluded, as far as we can tell, it excluded lunch breaks, overnight, and some weekends. But the government couldn't really articulate a principle as to what was the limiting principle on that de minimis exception, other than that it was solely meant to prevent its argument from descending into absurdity. So those were the three positions that were laid out before the court. Our principal argument, the three-day rule. Our secondary argument, no intra-session recess appointments at all, and the Department of Justice's plain meaning argument. Interestingly, the Court of Appeals panel, which consisted of Chief Judge Sentell, Judge Griffith, and Judge Henderson, was not enamored with our principal argument, and was not because in its view it did not reflect the proper original understanding of the Constitution. I disagree. I actually think that that there is a strong structural basis for our principal argument. The court, however, really didn't seem to like the government's position, which would make virtually any break in the action, a recess open for recess appointments subject to some nebulous and undefined de minimis exception, but instead was gravitating towards the original understanding argument, the argument that there can be no intra-session recess appointments at all. That was quite surprising to us. It was welcome to we were very open and welcome to that idea, but that's not how we anticipated things would go at argument, and I think it's definitely not how the government anticipated how things would go at argument. So the bottom line coming out of argument is that the court seemed to be leaning towards the original understanding position. If it were to reject that, though, just basically say there's too much water under the bridge, I think it's more likely that it would go with our secondary, with our principal position, as opposed to the Department of Justice's principal position. But it was a fascinating argument where I don't think any of us were crystal clear on where the court was heading when we came out of it. So that's basically where things stand. The one last update is that just the other day, the government submitted a 28J letter. That's the type of letter that you submit when there is new authority that you want to bring to the court's attention. The government didn't, in fact, cite any new authority. It dug up some old document that had marginal relevance that it wanted to bring to the court's attention, but its primary aim was to raise arguments that it either didn't previously raise or didn't raise very well in its briefs or at oral argument. One of the more interesting things that it suggested was that, in fact, these recess appointments, the ones made on January 4th, were made during an inter-session recess. And it defined that inter-session recess as beginning in December, when the Senate basically broke, subject to pro forma sessions every 3 days, began December 17th, ended January 23rd, which was the first sort of more traditional session that the Senate held after this period of holding pro forma sessions, and that everything in between was a recess, an inter-session recess. They made this argument tepidly, and at the very end of their 28J letter, it raises several problems, which we'll be noting in our response that I think we're going to be filing by the end of today. One of the most interesting ones, though, is if the government were right, that means that the terms of all of the recess appointees expired a couple of weeks ago when the Senate commenced the new session of Congress, something that I don't think perhaps the government appreciated, but perhaps not when it attempted to float this argument. Christian, that's about all I have to say about the case right now, and we can open it up to questions or comments from Glenn.
This is Christian. Thank you very much. I will now open the floor to questions from our call-in audience. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say, the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, to request the floor, press star and then the pound key. And it looks like we have our first question on the line.
Hi, this is Jim Markowski in New York. One facetious comment. It sounds like the Seventh Circuit was applying the Nixon standard. If the president does it, it's not illegal. But more seriously, as a matter of logic, if the Senate is not in session and thus a recess appointment is permitted, then shouldn't legislation that supposedly is enacted during a recess, as at least asserted by the administration, not be valid and should not have been properly signed into law because the Senate wasn't in session? If the Senate's in session, it can't enact legislation.
This is Glenn Taubman here. Yeah, I think that's a good point, and we certainly pointed that out in our brief, that the president asked the Senate to pass this legislation. It was the tax cut legislation. he signed it without protesting that there was anything wrong with the legislation. And so therefore, when the Seventh Circuit said to me, well, we think the Senate is being a little two-faced here by wanting to have its cake and eat it too, it seems to me that, in fact, it's the president that was being two-faced by calling for this legislation to be passed during what he knew was a pro forma session, signing the legislation that was passed during the pro forma session, but then saying, well, these pro forma sessions are, in essence, shams, and we can just ignore them for purposes of the recess appointment power. And Noel did a great job of explaining the three-day rule under the adjournment clause, and that has been the tradition for all of these years. And suddenly it's not a tradition anymore because they pretty much say, as Noel said, they can make recess appointments during lunch breaks and any other time they want. And in fact, when I made that argument to the Seventh Circuit panel, one of the judges, Judge Rovner, said something along the lines of, well, I don't think that the president would actually do that. You know, so again, the president gets this presumption that he is operating in good faith, but unfortunately, they weren't giving the Senate the same presumption about how it operates.
That example, the legislation also underscores a larger problem in the government's argument. The fact of the matter is, if you flip on C-SPAN, many Senate sessions, even ones that the government would agree are actual valid sessions, don't look any different than the types of sessions that were held on these during the period in which the government claims the Senate was in recess. There's usually very few senators on the Senate floor. That's because, as a general matter, the Senate operates via a process called unanimous consent, where you essentially, each party leader makes sure that his members don't disagree with a certain action that's going to be taken. Then they confer and assume, and given that there's no disagreement, the presiding senator moves that a particular action or a particular bill be passed by unanimous consent. Nobody objects, often because there's nobody else there to object, and hence it passes by unanimous consent. That's precisely how the extension of the payroll tax was passed on December 23rd in one of these so-called pro forma sessions, by unanimous consent. The government's ultimate position boiled down to the assertion that the Senate is in recess whenever it is capable of acting only by unanimous consent because there's not a quorum of senators on the Senate floor. Well, if that were the case, really, then the Senate would be in almost perpetual recess because there's almost never a quorum on the Senate floor given their standard operating procedure of acting by unanimous consent. That's how most laws are passed, and it's actually how most nominees are confirmed, by unanimous consent.
Great points, all of those, and I would add one more thing. A lot of people get hung up on the term pro forma session, but if you look at the amicus briefs that were filed by the Republican senators and by Speaker Boehner in Noel Canning, and if you look at the reports of the Congressional Research Service, which were cited in my reply brief, and I think Senator McConnell put these in the Congressional Record, these Congressional Research Service reports, they all say a pro forma session is the functional equivalent of any other session. I mean, we call it pro forma because it just has to do with our own scheduling and our own internal rules and policies, but it's no different than any other Senate session. And I think that's a key here.
Great. And with that, we'll move to our next caller.
This is David Tryon in Cleveland. Pretty simply, well, first of all, this is a very concise and informative presentation. Thank you both. This is great. I'm interested in the timing of what you anticipate the court to issue its decision, if you can predict that. And also, are there any other appellate decisions that you view as being imminent on this topic?
Certainly no other decisions that I view as imminent. Can you tell me the first part of your question again?
Well, for First, I was just saying it was a very concise and informative presentation, and I appreciate it. But the first, but then I just was interested to know if you have the any idea of when you anticipate the court
right.
deciding this.
Got it. Got it. Sorry. So no other decisions I think are imminent. You know, the way the D.C. Circuit typically operates, they clear their docket by the end of the summer. So the outside time period, I would say, would be August. And often in a case of this magnitude, they would take up that full period of time. I am hopeful that they'll act more quickly in this case, given that there is some time sensitivity here. The National Labor Relations Board either is or isn't operating lawfully. If it's not, then it's issuing additional decisions every single day that are unlawful, and hence it's in the court's interest to clarify sooner rather than later whether the NLRB is authorized. In addition, cases in the D.C. Circuit, every NLRB order is ultimately appealable to the D.C. Circuit. If the parties want to go there. In the D.C. Circuit, the court has been staying the briefing schedules of the cases that have been piling up pending resolution of this case. So that, I think, is an additional reason why we may see the D.C. Circuit act more quickly than usual. So if you throw that all into the mix, I'm hopeful that we'll hear a decision within the next couple of months or so.
Thanks.
Right. I would add to that. Of course, you never have any way of knowing when a court of appeals is going to issue. As Noel said, I think we're all hopeful that we'll get a decision here sooner rather than later. By my count, there's approximately 10 cases pending in the D.C. Circuit that are, I know, have raised this issue. And as Noel said, there could be new ones being filed every day because this NLRB continues to operate. According to the latest list that I have here, which is a list produced by the NLRB, there's a Ninth Circuit case, there's a Third Circuit case, there's a couple of Fourth Circuit cases. And for all we know, there could be others floating around out there because every day this board continues to issue. As I said at the end of my presentation, I just found out today that the Fourth Circuit has scheduled oral argument on March 22nd. In the enterprise leasing case. So, you know, we're moving forward, that's for sure.
This is Christian Corrigan again. We have one more question on the line. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then followed by the pound key, star followed by the pound key. A quick reminder that our next scheduled telephone conference call will be tomorrow, January 24th at 1 p.m., we will host a discussion on Dr. Arthur Brooks' new book, The Road to Freedom, How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise. Okay, our next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It's interesting that the government in this case seems to have once again invoked the plain language argument, making the presumption that pursuant to the rhetoric of supporters of the Constitution, that it is somehow written in plain English, when in fact it is written in the legal English of 1787 or 1791, whenever its components were ratified. And that it doesn't work to try to invoke plain language, which is subject to rapid change, to try to resolve legal cases. That reminds us of the way Justice Marshall did that in for the word necessary in McCullough and for the word commerce in Gibbons. If we don't challenge the very line of argument of using plain English rather than legal English, we open the door for all kinds of departures from original understanding of the Constitution.
You know, I think that's that's a good point, particularly when you're talking about complex provisions such as the Appointments Clause that interrelate with a variety of other provisions of the Constitution. I have to say that in many contexts, I often think that the plain language, that is how the language would have been understood at the time, is generally the right way to go. One of the problems in this area is that probably the best original understanding of the Recess Appointments Clause is that it was meant only to apply to intersession recess appointments, and that's why the clause refers to the recess of the Congress, not a recess or any recess, but the recess. It was referring to a relatively finite number of recesses that occurred when the senators departed on horseback and could not readily be recalled. Once you move away from that to allow intra-session recess appointments, you're then left with having to figure out, okay, what are the principles that cabin that? We think that the right principle is the one that's found in the structure of the Constitution, looking at other analogous provisions, the three-day rule. But the government instead tries to adopt a plain language argument in support of a position in intra-session recess appointments that were never contemplated in the first place. And so I think that's why you have a particular tension in trying to invoke a plain meaning definition in that context, which is why even the government couldn't stay true to its plain meaning interpretation, because it would have allowed recesses during lunch breaks, overnight, and over the weekend.
Yeah, I think it's worthwhile to remind ourselves that as of 1787, English had only been the established primary language of the English courts for less than a century. And it was still evolving to become usable as a language of law. So the original language of Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth, had begun to undertake a very profound change, borrowing from law, French, and Latin, in order to become adequate for use in the courts.
This is Christian Corrigan again. It looks like we have two more questions in line, so we'll go ahead and to make sure we get through both of them, to go on to our next question.
Hi, this is Mike Stern. I have one comment and one question. The comment has to do with Noel's description of the executive branch's position on making intra-session recess appointments. I realize that his description is absolutely the way pretty much everybody characterizes the executive branch's position, starting in 1921. But in actuality, what the Attorney General Daugherty said in 1921 was not that you could make intra-session recess appointments. What he said was, if you had a recess of a certain period, you could make a appointment during that time. But what the executive branch actually did between 1921 and 1948 was treat those as intercession recess appointments, so that the appointment expired at the beginning of the whatever the next recess was. My question.
Oh, is that true? I did not know that. So if, say, they made an appointment over Labor Day weekend, recess. Let's just say hypothetically, they made it over a Labor Day weekend recess. Then there was another intra-session recess over, you know, Thanksgiving. They would conclude that the appointment expired at the Thanksgiving recess.
Right. So the answer to that question is I don't know, because that issue never came up. What I do know is in the relatively, there were only a handful of appointments that they made under this theory between 1921 and 1948, and those they when they did not treat those as continuing for another session like they do now. It was only with the Comptroller General's opinion in 1948 that said they could do that, even though they had not been doing that, that they started to treat it as intra-session. Doherty, if you look at his opinion, never said anything about intra-session. He just says if the recess is, or the adjournment is of a certain length, we consider that a recess. He didn't actually say how long it would last, and he never had to face that question because they never made the appointment. But when they, the first time they actually used that theory to make an appointment, which was in the Coolidge administration, they did it for, you know, for the period that ended, you know, that Congress, not through the next Congress. So I mean, they never had to sort of address these theoretical issues, like what happens if there's another intraset, there's another non-final adjournment that could have been a recess, but should we have to treat it as a recess, but essentially a period. So they never had to get to that. But they clearly never said that these are intra-session recess appointments and we can continue them on to a full another Congress. Anyway, so my question is, if the government is now taking the position that this was an intra-session recess appointment, or possibly was, which is actually the logical implication of their argument about the disregarding the pro forma session, do you think that they plan to make new recess appointments, and can they do that?
Well, if they take the position that they have not explicitly taken. In fact, they disclaimed the position of oral argument. They said that this was not intersession; it was intrasession. Right. In their 28J letter, they sort of vaguely suggested that maybe this was an intersession recess that began on December 17th and ended on January 24th. If that were the view were to prevail, then I don't think they could make another intersession recess appointment. The current appointments will have expired, and they couldn't make another recess appointment until, you know, I guess December of this year, when presumably you'd see some similar kind of break between, you know, December and January.
Right. Okay.
This is Christian Corrigan again. We've got several more callers on the line, and we only have about 10 minutes left. And we do have a hard stop time at 2 o'clock, so I want to move on to our next caller.
Hi, Clinton Snow in Houston. I was just wondering if you could speak to the ramifications, if any, of a favorable decision out of the D.C. Circuit on Obama's recess appointment of the Richard Cordray for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Glenn, you want me to take that, or you want to take that?
Well, I do know that there is a lawsuit pending on this, right, Noel? Is it
yeah.
in the D.C. Circuit?
I'm not sure.
I mean,
where
in the district court, the U.S. district.
Yeah.
It's in a U.S. district
right.
court. Obviously, we who practice NLRB law get the advantage of NLRB decisions are appealed to courts of appeals. So we get to skip over U.S. district courts and go right to a court of appeals. I know, and now I should know where, but I know there is a district court case pending against Cordray, and I think it's in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. So presumably, if we get a favorable decision in Noel Canning, that's going to have an immediate and direct impact on the Cordray nomination as well. If that case is pending, say, in Texas, then it won't have a direct impact, but of course it'll have, you know, some authoritative view that a district court can consider.
The reasoning is exactly the same in both. If the NLRB appointments are illegal, so is Cordray's appointment. The CFPB, however, is a bit of an interesting beast. When it was created, it got two sets of authorities. First, Congress kind of collected a bunch of regulatory authorities that were being exercised by different agencies throughout the federal government, and it threw it into the CFPB. And then second, it gave the CFPB a range of new authorities that were never exercised before. The first bucket, the old authorities, can be exercised directly by the Secretary of the Treasury. And so those authorities can continue on regardless of whether Cordray was or was not illegally appointed. If Cordray was illegally appointed, though, the second bucket of authorities, the new ones, can only be lawfully exercised once you've got a lawful person in there. So any actions that the CFPB has taken pursuant to the new authorities would presumably be invalid if Cordray's appointment were held unconstitutional.
And I think that speaks to a point that Noel made earlier on in relation to my Seventh Circuit case and in relation to the way he got into the Noel Canning case, and that is that it is tough to find the proper vehicle to raise some of these challenges because, as the Seventh Circuit demonstrated, some courts are reluctant and they will use any of their tools to be able to avoid constitutional decision making, let us say. So, yeah, you have to work hard to find the right vehicle to make the challenge stick.
Yeah.
This is Bill Emanuel in Los Angeles. Thank you for a fabulous presentation and discussion. My question is this: assuming that that we win in the D.C. Circuit, how do you think the NLRB will react to such a decision?
Yeah, that's a real interesting question because, as a technical matter, a favorable decision would invalidate a single order. But the fact is that all orders are appealable to either the circuit in which the order was issued or to the D.C. Circuit. So every case can, if the parties are on their toes, ultimately find its way to the D.C. Circuit. So, you know, the NLRB faces a dilemma. Are they going to continue to exercise a power and throw monkey wrenches in the things, or are they going to basically put everything on hold until the Supreme Court resolves the issue? I don't know the answer to that question.
I would give you some speculation about it. Knowing this administration and the people who they appoint to positions, my guess would be that they'll continue to bull their way through and continue to issue decisions. And one of the things that I've thought about in my head is, so if the D.C. Circuit rules in rules in favor of Noel Canning and does the right thing, and I'm somebody with a case that's pending before the board right now, could I walk into a federal court and ask that the federal court enjoin the board from issuing a decision in my case because they're not a valid board and I don't want to have to be faced with getting a decision and then taking it up? Why shouldn't they be enjoined from even ruling in my case? So, you know, that's just something I've sort of thought in my head. I mean, what prevents somebody from doing that if Noel Canning comes out the right way? And that would be an interesting little satellite litigation right there about whether a federal court could enjoin the board from issuing a decision because they're not a valid board.
Great. Well, I think we do have just enough time for one last question.
Yes. Hi, this is Roman Martinez from Latham & Watkins. My question is about the president's power to unilaterally adjourn Congress if the two houses disagree about the time of adjournment. Is there any reason to think that the president couldn't do that and then subsequently make a recess appointment? And if so, how does that sort of play into this whole issue if the president has that power?
I can't say I know for sure the answer to your first question. But here, there wasn't any disagreement. That's the problem. I mean, that is the one way where the president can force an adjournment against Congress's will. If there is a disagreement, then he can step in and force the adjournment. Here, there was no disagreement. The House declined to pass a resolution of consent to the adjournment. As a result, the Senate couldn't adjourn, and it didn't attempt to. It didn't claim the power to. Instead, it held sessions every 3 days in order to satisfy the requirement that it adjourn every 3 days. So, you know, although I don't know for sure the answer to your first question, here it wasn't an issue because there was never a disagreement.
Right. I agree with that 100%.
Great. Well, with that, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both of our experts today. Thank you also to our audience. We welcome your feedback. And please do join us tomorrow, Thursday, January 24th at 1 p.m., for our call with Dr. Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute, talking about his new book, The Road to Freedom, How to Win the Fight for Free Enterprise. Thank you again to everyone. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.